From Johannesburg to Jerusalem, the world is always changing, growing and innovating. Join Benji Shulman for the next hour as he brings you the trendsetters, the thought leaders and those creating news before it happens. Only on the New Blue Review, your favorite Jewish culture and current affairs show. Every Monday at 9 a.m. right here on 101.9 High FM.
You're listening to 101.9 High FM. Hope you are having a fantastic Monday out there on this slightly soggy February morning and are nonetheless enjoying the rain. We need the rain. Can't ever complain about the rain. So I hope that you are having a great one and a great start to your week. What is up? Well, we've got a whole lined up show for you, as we always do. We're going to be talking about various things of current and cultural importance to our community. I'm happy to say that it is budget week. I'm not happy about budget week because that's not likely to go well. But because it's budget week and because Parliament is back, it means that later on in the show, we're going to be having Rob Hutchinson. He's going to be also going to be talking about arts and crafts and Israeli tech and what does it mean for our craft industry. So that's something. We're going to be looking at South Africa's response to the Trump administration. We're starting to see the first outlines of a South African response after a week of chest beating, and we're going to cover that in a moment. And we're also going to be looking at the war of history, which is now starting to take place in the Israeli public, and some of the fascinating things that are likely to become debating points for my children and your children when they study this period in history going forward. So that is what's going up on the show for today. If you want to be part of the show, as always, SMS us 34519. That is the SMS line, and we will certainly take your viewpoints because that is what we're here to do. So let's start off with South Africa today and South Africa's response to the Trump administration. This is a story that we've been following on this program now for 3 weeks in a row, and actually, quite frankly, in the whole country, this has been a very, very big deal. In case you haven't been following it too much, the Trump administration issuing various executive orders and statements around withdrawing aid from South Africa, and specifically making a big thing out of the expropriation without compensation. There has part of it was also refugee status for Afrikaners, a whole range of different elements. But basically, the threat is not just aid; it's also the trade. AGOA, which is our free trade agreement or preferential trade agreement with the United States, other potential problems around sanctions, really potential like wrecking of the South Africa-American relationship. And once we saw all of this happening, the first response, I think, from most of the commentators that I was certainly watching was a combination of panic, because there is a real risk here to the South African economy. AGOA itself is supposed to be worth 250,000 jobs, which would be a considerable blow given our current unemployment rate. And then the other side was a kind of machismo, well, you're not going to tell us what to do, we're a sovereign country, Zapiro was talking about Trump as being Hitler, and you know, everyone is talking about fascism, and all basically a lot of chest beating. Even in the speech to the State of the Nation, President Cyril Ramaphosa said, well, we won't be bullied. So that was the sort of first wave of responses. But you've started to see now this kind of, certainly on some commentariat, people who maybe are traditional center-left in the country starting to say, oh, wait, this is, the Americans are being serious here. And we can't just scream and shout at them like this is a more powerful country than we are. So what are we going to do about it? A little bit more of a constructive kind of approach. And that starts to be seeming to seep in. Cyril Ramaphosa was saying that what they want to do is send envoys to go explain to the Americans that this is what they don't understand. The Americans don't understand something, and so he wants to send envoys. A lot of people have said that this is not necessarily such a good idea, for a couple of reasons. The first is that the as somebody who's pointed out, a lot of the officials are not yet in place to actually have these sorts of discussions. Various people haven't been confirmed. There are problems with different other officials that are coming in. So there are issues around that. And, you know, so there are problems around that. So we're having a problem here where there's no one for them to talk to. And in the meantime, we don't know what Trump is going to do. So that could cause somewhat of a concern for people going forward. So we need to find out what is going to be there. And then the other issue is really what is the point of all of this? You know, if you can't just explain to the Americans what's going to happen, you need to actually change your behavior. And there doesn't seem to be so far anything that the South Africans are looking to do to change their behavior, whether it's on what was said in the executive order, which is around basically the accusation that South Africa is too close to Iran, too close to Hamas. We saw the sort of red flagging of a new sort of allegation, sort of that they're talking about nuclear issues, which is not something that South Africa has ever been accused of before. That should be a concern to the government, and so there's a real question of what are you going to tell the Americans if you're not going to tell them that you're changing something. And there's lots the South African government can change. They can amend the EWC Act. They can amend Bella. They can change the NHI. They can withdraw from the ICJ. They can do something about the Iranians. They can do something about Cuba, Venezuela, really any of Russia. They can stop military exercises. They can. There's really actually a lot of symbolic stuff. There's this Hague thing that they've put together. Grouping. So there's actually a lot of stuff, and it looks to me like what we're seeing here is Cyril Ramaphosa is doing what Cyril does, which is try and kick the ball down the road a little bit, try and create a process out of all of this. If you have a process, then you can have a chance to maneuver and control and drive things. And so what they're saying is they're sending envoys, but they're sending them around the world as if, you know, it's the French that we have a problem with, not the Americans. And the envoys are going to travel around the world to different places. He's pulled in some people who we last saw during the Palapala thing, who we haven't seen since then. And I think what they're trying to do is just slow down the process. Go to all the European capitals, meet with a bunch of people, and then go to the Americans and sort of hope that there's someone to meet there. Now, the question's going to be, is this going to work as a strategy for taking the air or the fire out of this discussion? And it's a real question. I don't know. The question is, I think, going to be, is Trump going to keep focus? The problem is going to be that, you know, Trump doesn't always keep focus on these sorts of things. He moves on to stuff a lot. The problem for South Africa is, first of all, we keep making signals which remind the American administration that we're doing things that are annoying them, like pushing the Taiwanese to move their embassy, which annoys everyone around Trump, and then that reminds him to get annoyed, and Elon Musk. And then the second thing is Trump just might do something because he's Trump. So I don't know if the South Africans are going to succeed in slowing this process down, but if they do, then it might give them some room to negotiate. But even if they do, they're going to have something to negotiate with. That is going to be a real challenge. I'm Benji Shulman. This is 101.9 High FM.
This is the New Blue Review with Benji Shulman.
101.9 High FM. And because we were talking about Sona last week and budget this week, that heralds the grand and triumphant, perhaps, return of Rob Hutchinson, our parliamentary correspondent. Rob, how are you doing? Happy New Year. We haven't even seen you this year yet.
Thank you, Benji. Thanks for having me on. What an intro. Really, wow. Good to be here as usual. I'm wondering if this morning I should be speaking in Afrikaans. If I can't, as an Afrikaans.
You could always take refuge in our station. Don't worry, Rob.
That's great news.
So, Rob, before we get onto some of the stuff that we normally get onto, which is, you know, what are some of the things coming down the pike that, of course, on Dear South Africa, people comment on. We've had the Sona. We have a budget coming up. Is it tomorrow, the budget speech, I think? Or is it Wednesday?
Yeah. Yeah, it's Wednesday.
Wednesday. Yeah. Okay.
Well, so she's not too sure.
Okay. Sometime this week. And people are starting to telegraph some pretty hair-raising things. Taxation going up. There's rumors that the GNU is not completely happy with the budget. We like to talk about belt tightening. There's not much belt left. So what are the sorts of things that you're hearing around what we might expect to see in the budget coming up this week?
It's much and much of the usual stuff as we've seen over the years. Lots of promises, lots of focus on social services, increasing the grants and so on. With a strong focus on fixing the energy crisis in South Africa. I think that'll be a welcome spend for most people. And also probably a restructure on certain taxes and so on. The government does, after all, need money in order to spend it, although they spend it as if there's an endless pool, as we know. But not much unusual. There's talk about the NHI as it always has been, with more focus on that. And nothing too out of the ordinary so far. But again, you never know. There's always a chance for them to throw a spanner in the works for the budget.
Okay, so that's the budget side of things. Now, Rob, it's interesting you've got one of your campaigns going at the moment, which is something that we've been covering tangentially, I guess, on this program with you and with others for a while, and that's the question of name changes. The issue of Leila Khaled Drive has been something which has been irking Johannesburgers for quite some time. I saw somebody had said that this was a piece of ANC pontifery which turned into a national. What's it? They called it a national risk point or something like that, like basically a danger to the national health because it was annoying the Americans. So name changing is a big issue. And obviously this particular case was because someone was particularly, egregious. But it looks like Minister Gayton McKenzie is wanting to change the whole way that we look at name changes in the first place. So maybe chat to us about that, because that is something that listeners here have been very interested in.
Oh, definitely, Benji. I mean, it is always a contentious issue. And as you say, the response on the name change for Leila Khaled Drive was immense, absolutely immense. And it's an extremely contentious issue that has always drawn problems with South Africans, particularly around, because names of geographical places are supposed to be named around geographical places and not international interference, and supposed to go through a local process as well as follow a general guideline. So what Mr. Gage McKenzie has put out is amendments in the way that geographical names in the processes which they are being followed or processes that you have to follow to actually have them changed. And what they're doing is proposing a whole new way, including establishing provincial committees instead of having it bound to a local municipality only. There will be a provincial committee, so provincial provinces have oversight over the name changes and make sure that they abide by the rules, and of course therefore encourage adequate public consultation, which we haven't seen in the past. So the bill also takes care of adequate public consultation, make sure that the public are involved, and that, of course, government listens to the concerns of the public surrounding name changes. So we don't go through the same issue that we've had with the renaming of Sandton Drive. And, of course, they've also established an appeals process, a tribunal that will oversee it. Anybody, stakeholders, can lodge a complaint and bring that in front of the tribunal to challenge the whole process and challenge the name changes that any municipality, province, or national government does put forward.
Okay, so really what we're seeing is that instead of just your local mayor being able to sort of pop a name change because it feels like it, what we're seeing here is maybe a few more processes, more oversight, just a general increasing in the amount of work that a local authority might have to do to change a particular name in the South African context.
Yes, yes, with a strong focus on getting the public involved as well, which is what's been seriously lacking in the past. And that's a good thing. It's actually good to see a process like this being undertaken. Let's hope it goes well for the public. From judging from the public participation, I can see people are still extremely frustrated around name changes, and for good reasons. Hopefully this amendment will alleviate all of that and allow people to get more involved in it, and that government make sure that government actually listens to the concerns of the public.
Okay, so you can also comment on the process of the process of name changes on Dear South Africa. We'll give you all those details as we go forward. Rob, what else is going on in the parliamentary processes that we need to be keeping our eye on in the sort of Q1 of 2025?
In the Q1 of 2025, quite a few things, actually. Quite a few bills have been put out through the government gazettes lately, local and national. One is a review of the City of Joburg's land use scheme, which the public should have a look at that. There's quite an extensive rework of it. It's part of their special planning process, Bloomer. But what this, the amendments here allow for the formalization of informal settlements, which is, there's a whole new section that's been put into it and how that process must go about. And quite a few concerns in the whole application process of formalizing informal settlements. We know that's quite a problem within the City of Joburg's boundaries. But this new section makes it clear how this process will go out. But as I said, there are a few concerns which the public should be aware of, and along with definitions in that as well.
Yes, yeah, so, I mean, look, that this is a very sort of town planning technical issue around how do you create a new area. It's in Johannesburg, they call it creating a township, which is not actually a township in the colloquial sense. It's a technical term meaning a place where buildings are going to stand and people are going to live or whatever. But I'm assuming that this is coming because in a place like Orange Farm or something like that, people never lived there and there was just land vacant, often government land, and people just move in. And instead of to get rid of people, the government is saying, well, all right, let's just make it available to them. The question is, are they actually going to give people title deeds, or is it just going to be proclamation for public service? What actually is some of the things that's going to affect how the city is governed at an urban level?
Well, given title deeds, I think that city has just undergone a whole process now of handing out title deeds in the past week. That'll always go on, but that's way further down the line. The first step would be to formalize the informal settlements and provide services and such as healthcare services, electricity, formal electricity, water, sanitation, and so on. And then formalizing the actual structures. So there's also, along with that, there's building plans, that building regulations that need to be considered, what type of land it can be, what type of structures it can be, and the land use as well, what they can do on the land or portions of the land. And this applies to private as well as government or city-owned land. So again, we can look at that if you have squatters that move in on a large piece of land and it's privately owned, you have to be quite cognizant of this new amendment here to this bill. And one thing that you should take note of is there's an immense amount of changes to the definitions within the document, which is quite unusual. I haven't seen that many amendments to definitions before, but it's quite a sneaky way of government getting around changing the laws, rather change the definitions that the laws govern. But again, it's over 35 pages of amendments to definitions. So some of them quite concerning, redefining what constitutes a bed and breakfast, for example. So are you allowed to do this? Is this now a bed and breakfast? Is my bed and breakfast still classified as a bed and breakfast, which might be a concern to Airbnb hosts and the like. But yeah, the quite a few changes on that side.
So basically, if you're someone who manages a building, or is someone who builds buildings, or is maybe even involved in some part of a zonal dispute around what is commercial or residential property, because that often comes up as an issue in the city, I know, these are all things that you might want to look at in terms of these local regulations.
That is correct. Absolutely correct, yeah. All the way down to even if you want to do alterations on your own home, that's that kind of thing. So you might not be a commercial operator, even in a private individual, you'll still need to abide by these new regulations and definitions.
Okay, so that's important. If you're a local Joburger, you can go check that one out. Also, Rob, obviously a lot of discussion around healthcare at the moment. You did mention the NHI issue. That's likely to come up in the budget. So around that is a bunch of law stuff which comes up. So what is going around in the health part of this discussion?
That's a brand new amendment that's been put out from the Department of Trade and Industry and Competition. It's around amendments to the Competition Act, specifically on health, on the healthcare sector. What they're proposing here is to formalize tariffs and fees within the healthcare sector. You know, as you've seen, there can be such a variation between certain procedures and healthcare services, and even in pharmaceuticals and drugs and so on, that you can pay so much for one here and then hardly anything for something else there. What government is proposing here is a standardization of tariffs and healthcare services, even down to pharmaceuticals and medicines and so on. But that must be discussed between service providers, doctors, pharmaceuticals, any kind of stakeholders, medical aids, and so on. To come towards a standard tariff across the Act, which seems kind of counterintuitive to the whole Competition Act thing.
You're kind of right enforcing. But also, aren't prices of medicine in particular regulated already? What is different about the...
Yes.
So what's different here?
So this would be more towards services and drugs used within the services. So... well, I couldn't give you an example. I'm not a healthcare provider, but
but you're looking more like somehow. I mean, off the top of my head, like what a doctor might charge to do something, or yes, for extra surgeries or something like that, perhaps.
Correct. So more services, but it does also boil down to medicines and supply of medicines and so on. I'm not sure in detail of how they're going to control that. But it does seem to be they're inviting a stakeholder process to discuss standardization. So you don't see such variations across the field from sector to sector, mainly aimed at the lower income there to bring the prices of healthcare down.
But is this actually part of, let's call it, the greater NHI universe, or is this just a standalone thing that the government is trying to control some part of the medical sector because prices are an issue as far as they're concerned?
I think this is a preamble to the NHI. So standardize everything across the range, and then it'll pave the way for NHI implementation at a later stage, because government knows that the NHI is not going to be implemented for quite a few years to come. So rather tack the processes that lead up to that in the meantime.
Interesting. Now, Rob, the whole thing around EWC that we've seen and NHI, Bella, all of these bills that have come and been so contentious for the GNU and even for apparently Donald Trump and all these people, it's brought to life the question about how, as always, the laws are made and then implemented, and also the regulations that are connected with it. And I thought it might be worth spending 2 minutes just talking about it so that people understand how this works, because you hear different people saying different things. So, for example, if we take the EWC thing, the DA minister, Dean McPherson, say, well, the president has to sign it off with me, so it doesn't really apply. And also, I'm going to not have regulation. I'm going to regulate this differently from from the law, so that you have a broad law, but the regulations themselves don't actually apply. And other people saying, well, the president can still amend this, even though he signed it off. So give us a bit of a sense about this point where the president signs a bill into an act. What options are available for people to want to change it? Because that's kind of what we do here in this discussion segment or every week is to talk about the pre. But now, okay, we have a post problem now. So what happens post?
No, exactly. I saw that comment by Dean McPherson. I had a bit of a chuckle, because at the end of the day, he has to implement what the president says. The president has final say in the processes. The president goes through goes through parliamentary committee. The parliamentary committee discusses it. Then the minister has a look at it. The public has a look at it. And then it goes back to National Assembly. And if the parliamentary committee signs it off, then it goes through to the NCRP, National Council of Provinces. And then it goes off to the president's desk if there are no amendments to it. But the president can look at it and say, no, this needs to be changed, and this is what needs to be put in. And he'll send it back to Parliament and keep that process open and open and open. And the president, I mean, there's so many bills sitting on his desk right now. And he has a look through it. When I say he, I mean the presidency, themselves, have a look through it. The legal people go through it. And also, you can also talk to the president and request something to the presidency on how to interfere with that process or force him to send it back to National Assembly. At the end of the day, the minister has to implement what the outcome is, like the final bill, which would now be an act. However, the minister does have unilaterally draft the regulations surrounding that. So in that sense, Mr. McPherson is correct. So, and of course, the regulations determine how the bill is or act is rolled out at the end of the day. But there again, it might create public interaction there, and it might create conflicts and court challenges as well.
Well, there you go. Rob, thank you so much for joining us on the show today. If you want to comment on any of the things that we've been speaking about today, the Name Changes Act, the housing and township regulation, the healthcare, or a range of other things, dearsouthafrica.co.za is the place to go, Rob. Thank you so much for joining us. We'll chat to you again next week.
Thank you very much, Benji. Have a wonderful week further.
There we go. Rob Hutchinson, I'm Benji Shulman. This is 101.9 High FM.
This is the New Blue Review with Benji Shulman.
I am Benji Shulman. This is the New Blue Review, and you are listening to 101.9 High FM. Now, after every single major war in Israel, one of the things that you find is that there is a fight, effectively, or an argument, not just in the world, but even inside Israeli society, around the history of a particular moment, and particularly a particular war. And these happen for all of the wars that Israel's ever fought. And it's very important, because the public memory of how things happened often governs future decisions that the state takes on certain issues, and also the legacies of major figures in Israeli life. So I think the classic example is Golda Meir, and the fact that she missed, in some respects, the war machine that was coming over the border in 73. If you've watched that movie Golda, a lot of that movie spends time discussing that particular point. But more than that, you also have the key points in the war, which people may not realize at the time, start to become apparent. And this applies to all the wars. Again, 67 is a six-day thing, and if you go into the history, you can see when, for example, the Israeli army went into Jerusalem, or in 73, the point at which they decided to strike back against the Syrians and then the Egyptians. So these are all crucial points, but people don't realize it at the time. And what we're starting to see in Israel now, and if you hear it in the news, when Lindy West speaks in 15 minutes' time, she's talking about Lindy West starting to talk about a commission which looked into the defense of Kibbutz Nir Oz, which is likely to be one of those inflection points that people talk about. And of course, when eventually there is a proper discussion of what is going on in terms of the war, like a proper investigation, which I think they've put off for 3 months, then you start to get some kind of a history of the war, although people are invariably never happy with the official histories, but it's the start. But you also start to get the informal histories that start to appear. So, for example, this war, we've already seen Meir Tobon, who's a journalist, and he speaks about his time that he had dealing with the question of defending the kibbutzim, obviously a key point. Micha Goodman, who is a Israeli public intellectual, he's written a book called The Eighth Day, which is about the war, which he wrote during the war. And the title, The Eighth Day, refers to actually a book called The Seventh Day, which is about the Six-Day War, which recorded the lives of soldiers as they fought in the 1967 war. So we've started to see some of the informal histories that are also starting to be written. But what you're also starting to see is the third part, which is the role that the big players take in decision-making and what they see as their role at certain times. And we've kind of seen the first take, actually, of that coming in the last couple of weeks with Yoav Gallant, is a former defense minister. And he had a famously fractious relationship with Bibi. Even before the war, they were trying to kick him out. Well, Bibi was, because of his view on the judicial reform. And he's kind of seen as quite a right winger. But as soon as they were kicked out, then suddenly Bibi fired them and unfired him because there were mass protests. And then after the war, he got fired again. And now he's deaf parliament. And now he's starting to effectively give over his version of the war. And what's fascinating is that he is locating it the second most important date, as we start to think about these dates that are important in 67 and 73. What is the most important date? Well, he's arguing that it actually might have been after the 7th of October, the 11th of October. And this is fascinating because we had heard rumors that been discussions in the Israeli press about this, but this is the first time that someone's really come out and said it. And basically, what he's saying is that on the 11th of October, Hezbollah had been starting to fire onto Israel for several days, and the Israeli military understood that what they were trying to do was divide up the country, not do a full-scale invasion, but to try and keep Israel distracted and prevent any kind of serious engagement with Gaza. At that stage, remember, it had only been a few days since they had managed to clear the south of invaders, and now they were looking to see what to do next. And Yoav Gallant had this idea that he said he believed that it was time to take out Hezbollah. Nasrallah was meeting with all of his commanders. They knew where all the missiles were because they were still in storage at that stage, about 90% of them. So they believed that they could take them out. And also, you know, later on there was the beeper attack, which everybody knew about. But the fact is that the beeper attack seems to have only been plan B. The plan A was actually these walkie-talkies, which actually had three times the amount of explosives as the beepers. And the plan was to take out Nasrallah and then start an assault on the missiles. And then as Hezbollah starts to put on all of its gear to go to war, then suddenly you would have these walkie-talkies blow up and take out not the 2,000 or 3,000 that we saw in the beep attack, which was amazing enough, but actually 15,000 of Hezbollah's fighters. And as far as Gallant was concerned, the time had come to do this. The country was united. There was support diplomatically, so to speak. The Nasrallah was available. There was enough support from the Iron Dome and from other things on the battlefield, so it could be done. And there was a fight inside the Israeli government. Bibi wasn't happy with it. He thought that it would release lots of weapons into central Israel. There was concern about the Americans, who had said, remember, Biden said don't. That applied as much to the Israelis as it did to Hezbollah. And there was a serious fight inside the Israeli government. And in fact, it led to bringing in some other partners into the government in order to try and block this as a move. And as it happened, Israel ended up doing this later on in the war. But Gallant is making the argument that actually they should have done at that stage. Now, of course, it was inconceivable. I mean, we think that this is normal now, that you could just do a beeper attack, right? It was inconceivable to people. People weren't keen. They didn't believe that the IDF had the proper organizational ability because they just failed in Gaza. But actually, they probably could have. And so Gallant is making this case that in a war, you don't start with, if you've got a two-front war, you start with the difficult enemy first, which is actually Hezbollah. It had opened the war, and that maybe they missed an opportunity to do it. So this is his first brush with history, and we're going to start to see more of it as it goes along. But it looks like the first day that is going to be the argument around a pivotal part in this war is going to be the 11th of October, 2023. I'm Andrew Shulman, and this is 101.9 Chai FM.
This is the New Blue Review with Benji Shulman.
101.9 Chai FM. Now, what happens when Israeli ingenuity meets the African arts and crafts industry? Well, I can tell you now because it's a really interesting story. A group of Israeli entrepreneurs have gotten together to support the craft industry in Africa. And of course, in South Africa, you know, it's almost something you don't think about because it's everywhere, right? But if you go overseas, if somebody gets a little beaded animal of some description, or a little painted piece of kente cloth, or something like that, people really appreciate it because it's so unusual. And, you know, here, literally just drive down the road and somebody is selling an amazing piece of art and you don't even notice. And so some Israelis came to South Africa and they noticed these arts and crafts people. And they thought, well, how do you get this to people around the world? And so a group got together called Arts of Africa. And they specifically focused on the American market. They have arts and crafts in Swaziland, of Kenya, I think one other country as well. And by using sort of global logistics thinking, because the problem with crafts that are smaller to medium sized is that the cost to send them is very high. And so there's no, when the cost to DHL something, for example, somewhere is the same cost as the whole product, or double it or triple it, then it's very hard to start making a profit off of this. And I guess this is what like companies like Amazon managed to do very well with books, is make it possible to do this sort of thing. And so these guys have worked out how sort of some of the global supply chain logistics stuff works. And what they're doing is they're applying this now to the crafts market and the craft market in Africa. And what they're trying to do is take all of these crafts in these different countries, empower the local communities to make them, but also to actually have them get closer to the person, right? When it comes to African arts and crafts, you imagine that probably the creator of the good and service is probably quite far from the consumer, because it's made it and then it went to a local market, and then from the market it went to a third person, and the third person sent it to someone in America, and the American person sent it to a shop. And it's a long chain. And so what they're trying to do is actually connect the maker of the product directly with the people who want to buy it, which means that the people on the ground can have more profit and cut out the middleman. And so it's a new business. It's a typical Israeli startup. But I think it's exciting to see that the world of startup nation can be applied even to our amazing African crafts industry. And it's a good sign that even in the current circumstances that we're still seeing those sorts of engagements. So you can go check it out. It's called Arts of Craft Africa, artsofafrica.com. And you can go see. I don't think you'll find it particularly amazing in terms of the crafts that they have. The crafts are good. I'm not saying they're bad. It's just that if you're a South African, you see it all the time. But what's amazing is the system behind it, so that hopefully the Americans can get to see more of our great African crafts. And brings us to the end of the show for today. Thank you so much for joining us. Thank you to Craig, who pushes all the big red buttons, Vusi, who's on the sound, and to you, dear listener, who joins us every single week. Do join us again next week on the New Blue Review.